This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
Are you ready?
Let's go.
From AMI Central.
Now circling in the neutral zone.
Here's the pitch on the way. 36 yards for the win.
This.
Here comes a big chance. The shot.
Is
this the dagger?
The neutral zone.
This is as good as it gets.
Now, here's your host, two-time Paralympian, Brock Richardson.
What's going on, sports friends? It's time for another edition of The Neutral Zone. I am indeed your host, Brock Richardson, and this week I'm joined by Claire Buchanan. Claire, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Brock. It's a beautiful Friday evening, and the weekend is upon us.
Indeed, indeed it is. It's going to be a jam-packed weekend if you are a Blue Jays fan and also scoreboard watching, because the Blue Jays, it looks like they have to sweep and get some help of the one, the only Baltimore Orioles. And I'm going to give an extra special welcome to our next co-host, because our next co-host this week aligned both of our guests this week. He did some chasing, and we really appreciate it. And Cam, we're going to have Devin Haru and Ari Shapiro. Welcome to the program, and thanks so much for the extra help this week.
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it's a team effort. You've gotten so many guests on the show, and so is Claire and Josh. And yeah, at the end of the day, it's just a team effort. So, and I'm also looking forward to this weekend for the wild card weekend, and hopefully the Jays can sweep and get a few losses from Boston and Seattle and New York, and hopefully they kind of sneak in there.
Yes, it's going to definitely be a sneak in there if they do get in there. And of course, we'll dive into that with Ari Shapiro coming up in our second segment of the program, and then followed by Devin Haru, who was actually on the ground in Tokyo. We've gotten perspective from athletes, and of course, Scott Russell has joined us throughout this whole process, and it'll be good to get Devin's take on what kind of went on in that regard of being a select few people who from the media were on the ground. It's now time, before we get into all of that, to get into our headlines for this week.
Earlier this week, it was announced that the Tampa Bay Rays would have a Montreal sign hanging in foul territory that would symbolize the partnership between the Tampa Bay Rays and Montreal during this year's playoff run at Tropicana Field in St. Petersburg, Florida. However, there will no longer be a sign displayed because St. Petersburg and the Rays want to stand by their current partnership. I think it was a bad idea to even talk about having that sign because they've been in Tampa this entire year, and you want to be able to celebrate that and not kind of have a cloud hanging over being a team that's possibly going to be going to Montreal, or at least half the time. So I'm glad that they reversed that decision and they're making it all about the Rays, which they should.
The NBA has denied Golden State Warriors player Andrew Wiggins' request for a vaccination exemption due to religious reasons. This is a very interesting topic that I was surprised when I read it that Andrew had to put this through. I wasn't surprised necessarily with the end result, but we also have found out that the Toronto Raptors will allow unvaccinated players to be on their court when they compete in Toronto. We'll discuss that and much more in regards to all of this a little later on in the program.
HC Donbass, the Ukrainian team that Jalen Smerek plays for, is urging the Ice Hockey Federation of Ukraine to change its course in the handling of Andrei Daniskin's suspension, writing on Twitter that they demand a reconsideration of the decision. Daniskin was suspended for 3 games plus an additional 10 games that can be negated if he chooses to pay a $50,000 fine instead. This is all a result for the racist gesture he directed towards Smerek during a game on Sunday. Now, to put it in perspective, this $50,000 fine, converted from Ukrainian currency to US dollars, is only under $200. So this this guy's getting three games and able to come back no problem. And this guy shouldn't be able to be in the league anymore because of this.
The Chicago Bears took a major step toward moving out of their longtime home at Soldier Field, one of the most recognizable stadiums in the United States, and into the suburbs by signing a purchase agreement for Arlington Park, about 30 miles northwest of the city. We are excited to have executed a purchase and sale agreement for the Arlington Park property, Bears President and CEO Ted Phillips said in a statement. Much work remains to be completed, including working closely with the Village of Arlington Heights and surrounding communities before we can close on this transaction.
Those are your headlines for this week. It's time to check in on our Twitter poll questions. Let's go back to last week. The question was, do you think Paralympic athletes should also receive money for winning medals? 85% said yes, 10% said no, and 5% said neither should. This week's question, do you think the Tampa Bay Rays organization will eventually move to Montreal? Your choices are quite simple, yes or no. You can cast your votes after the program today at all of our Twitter handles, which will be given out in a little bit on the program. Coming up next, we're going to speak with Ari Shapiro, who is going to be chatting with us about the Toronto Blue Jays and what state they're in as we're headed in to their final three games of the regular season. Will they make the playoffs? Won't they? He'll give us all the scoop right after this. You're listening to The Neutral Zone on AMI Audio. Stay with us.
And welcome back to the Neutral Zone AMI broadcast booth.
Play ball.
And we are set to get this ball game underway. The first pitch brought to you by Brock Richardson's Twitter account at Neutral Zone BR. First pitch, strike. And hey, gang, why not strike up a Twitter chat with Claire Buchanan for the Neutral Zone? Find her at Neutral Zone CB. And there's a swing and a chopper out to second base right at Claire. She picks up the ball, throws it over to first base for a routine out. And fans, there is nothing routine about connecting with Cam and Josh from the Neutral Zone. At Neutral Zone, Cam J and at JWatson200. Now that's a winning combination. And this Oregon interlude is brought to you by AMI Audio on Twitter. Get in touch with the Neutral Zone. Type in at AMI Audio.
Welcome back to the Neutral Zone right here on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, alongside Cam Jenkins and Claire Buchanan. And we're pleased to be joined by journalist, publisher, and host of the podcast Whiskey and Cream. Ari Shapiro joins us to discuss the Toronto Blue Jays as they approach their final weekend of the regular season. Friend of the show, Ari Shapiro, welcome back. Nice to talk to you again.
Brock, it's always a pleasure because you always find the time to invite me at some of the most controversial or frustrating moments that baseball fans across the country seem to be experiencing. So it's always a pleasure to be an armchair psychoanalyst and work with you and the crew here to figure out what went wrong the other night.
Ari, why don't we just start off with how would you categorize the Toronto Blue Jays season overall, given that they had three different home locations this season?
Yeah, that's a great question, Cam. And the truth is, this has not been a season like any other, which is one of the reasons why I tend to not so much temper my criticism, but unlike so many emotional folks on social media who've had to deal with so many ups and downs this year, it's always important to keep perspective. And I'm glad that you brought up the fact that this was a year that this baseball club found itself like nomads, wandering the pandemic baseball sea, trying to figure out whether they're good enough to make the playoffs and take that next step forward. And if you had told this group of youngsters that, hey, you're going to do it in the middle of the fourth wave of the pandemic, where you will be responsible for providing bona fide escapism, right? This is what this is. We have to be clear. What the Blue Jays have done over the last few days especially has made a lot of people forget about this pandemic that love baseball. And for that, I give them mad props and a great deal of credit. They did it while traveling across the United States of America, which of all the countries in the world in terms of their capacity to handle the pandemic don't exactly come across as stellar in any respect. So here they are in the land down south doing their best to compete. And for all intents and purposes, they have proven throughout the course of this baseball season that they have the talent to be taken very, very seriously. And that's extremely redeemable considering the circumstances and where we're at with this coronavirus threat.
Can you talk a little bit about how difficult it is for a professional sports team to play in three different locations in the same season?
Boy, you know, psychologically, that's got to be something, aside from being unprecedented, right? Given the fact that they started their journey in a place like Florida and then Buffalo and then eventually coming back to Toronto, you could say that this team has really come to understand the very nature of adversity when it comes to being a professional athlete, this on-the-road club that's going around to these different U.S. cities trying to prove its salt. I'd say that this is just simply unprecedented. It's hard to even compare this to anything given the circumstances, which is all the more reason why last night, I think, was so frustrating and painful for so many people, including myself. And I'm still trying to get my head around the adversity of what it must be like for these Blue Jays young players like a Vlad Guerrero Jr. and a Bo Bichette and a Lourdes Gurriel to really have their feet to the flame, if you will. Circumstances they can't control and doing the best that they've been able to demonstrate. I think there are a lot of great stories in this respect. As an organization, they need to be very proud about their resiliency. And considering that they made the playoffs last year and trying to compete and are trying to do it this year and have kind of moved on from those loser tags of reclamation projects and faint hopes back in 16, 17, and 18 that one day this team could be competitive, fans of this club need to understand you've got one hell of a ball club. And there's no reason to think that they won't be competitive for many, many years to come. And the fact that they did it on the road, In a foreign area, a foreign land, if you will, it's a great baseball success story, no doubt.
Harry, you did mention about last year how they did squeak into the playoffs, and then this year, if they do make it, which we're all hoping they do, that they'll squeak in again. Where do you think that puts them in their development stages? Or do you think that they're ahead of schedule or a little behind?
Well, this sounds like a trick question because you know full well that I myself have always been a very harsh critic of the organization during the Shapiro-Atkins regime. And for many years, I felt it was not only warranted, but my big concern is what was this expectation, what was this arc that they were anticipating when it came to talent evaluation and projecting for the future? If you'd asked me this question 3-4 years ago, you already knew what the response was. I'm pretty sure Brock asked me that question that many years ago, back when they were just kind of struggling and the organization was doing things as frugally as possible, right? There was no real sense of investment in the ball club. Well, the reality is all of that has changed. And because it has changed, because they went out and spent the money on acquiring marquee players and big names like Ryu and George Springer, it's safe to say that they're in unprecedented waters when it comes to anticipating what this team would ultimately become. Because if you had told me that by 2021, the Toronto Blue Jays would have a Rookie of the Year, Cy Young, and MVP top rank hopeful on their roster, I'd tell you that you're absolutely insane. And the reality is just that. This team has a dearth of position players and a level of talent that I think not even in the wildest dreams did management think would mature this quickly. I mean, this isn't a year where Danny Jansen and Kevin Biggio have been basically write-offs, right? This is a year where you have a lot of players that were expected to come out of the gate and do well who struggled. And now you're looking at this roster with, one series left to play, and you're saying to yourself up and down, this team pound for pound is one of the top five most talented teams in Major League Baseball. So to answer your question, they are way ahead of schedule because in terms of having control over important contracts, I think it shouldn't shock your panel for me to say that we have to enjoy Vlad Guerrero Jr. as long as we can, because the truth is it might just be for two or three more years. Because by the time he hits his mid-20s and with his bargaining position as a free agency, it's going to be hard for a club like Toronto to keep a player of that magnitude. So the fact that they can still have two more full competitive years after this one and where they're at as a projection of their capacity to perform, I'd say this is quite a renaissance for fans of the team across Canada.
Speaking of our MVP candidate, Vladdy Guerrero, what do you believe has been the biggest difference maker in this season for Vladdy?
Well, you know, it's interesting to be asked that question when he's, you know, coming off of an 0 for 20 slump when the team needs him most. Because it, for some of your older demographic listeners who are baby boomers and Gen Xers, George Bell went 0 for 36 to end the 1987 season, which was one of the greatest collapses in American League history. So to see that kind of happening right now, it made me smirk and made me very nostalgic in that regard. But one thing that especially makes me appreciate the George Bell of that era was the performance of Vlad Guerrero Jr. This year, I think the biggest difference is that he has become infinitely more patient. It's almost as if his father and his trainers and his handlers and anyone that really matters in baseball in his circle finally got to him and told him the importance of staying back and letting pitches come to him. I think the early Vlad that we saw was just bursting with all this talent and in the process probably let his ego drive his at-bats rather than his training, rather than his raw talent. What we're seeing this year is a Vlad Guerrero Jr. who goes up to the plate with a plan and tries not to deviate from it. You don't hit over 300 in baseball unless you know what you're doing in this sport. That's how fundamentally difficult it is. Even with this live ball, juice ball era, and with so much going on offensively, it is still incredibly difficult to hit 300 in this league. Well, Vlad didn't just find a way to up his resiliency and discipline level. He's now a bona fide perennial, I believe will be a perennial triple crown candidate. And even though he's not going to win it this year, the fact that he finally, quote, got it and figured it out is like a switch going on in his head. And as long as he stays focused, and I need to add this to this whole panel to appreciate, he not only has to stay focused, guys, he has got to keep fit. He's got to keep healthy. Because the biggest difference this year from previous Vlad years was that he came to camp in much better shape. You know, when he first burst on the scene here, he literally came woefully prepared. And there were many, many comments about his physicality and how he approached the game. And if you look at some of his early injuries, they were a direct result of just not being conditioned well enough. Well, this year, leaner, fitter, smarter, more dynamic Vlad. And now we're seeing the player that everybody had hoped he could one day become.
We're joined by Ari Shapiro, journalist, publisher, and the host of Whiskey and Cream podcast. And he's chatting with us about the Toronto Blue Jays, and I'm your host, Brock Richardson, joined by Claire Buchanan and Cam Jenkins, and you're listening to Neutral Zone on AMI Audio.
Ari, there has been quite a lot of discussion on this program, by me in particular, about whether or not the Toronto Blue Jays manager, Charlie Montoyo, has done a good job or a bad job with this team, which is more my view with the bullpen. How would you grade him for this year and why?
Cam, there's an old expression in baseball that's one of my favorites, and I'm not quite sure who coined it. But I remembered from years gone by during the era of Billy Martin and Chuck Weaver and then going to the types of Blue Jays managers out there like Aceto Gaston. And even most recently in their efforts to try to find the right manager, the expression managers can't win baseball games, but they sure as hell can lose them. And if you want me to grade him, I'll be absolutely blunt for you and your listeners. Charlie Montoyo is the reason why, if the Blue Jays do not make it into the playoffs this year, he's that reason. And that's just not a question of understanding analytics, because, you know, I look at their 18 or 19 losses as a direct result of bullpen mismanagement. It's probably not a fair statement because, look, your bullpen's going to lose some games. One of the problems this year was that Charlie Montoyo, unfortunately, maybe it was a consequence of seeing the other players evolve and the team getting better, he decided to get more actively involved in what was previously seen as very much a laissez-faire manager, which, by the way, we had one around these parts. His name was Clarence Cito Gaston, and he did exactly what you needed to do when you had that much talent on your roster and simply needed to put the parts in and run with it. He stayed out of their way. He did what Montoyo tries to do, which is protect them, especially in the last couple of years, by getting involved during disputes. You know, we had that who was it, Barricky pitch that caused all that trouble where we had benches, emptying and a lot of anger and frustration. But if you think about it, that's a tremendous positive. I like that. He stood up there. But at the same token, when I look at his performance as a manager from the start of the year to this point, I can count on both hands, I'll maybe say fully fingers, all 10 examples I could give you right now as a separate show of dubious and questionable moves that Charlie Montoyo made when you least expected it. And as a result of that, if you recall earlier in the season, he started developing a reputation for that, especially on social media. If you spend time on Twitter, you appreciate the armchair quarterbacks and critics there who are sitting and evaluating this. And it's easy to do that. I mean, hell, I'm doing that right now. So there's a little bit of irony to that. But it's warranted. It's warranted because I would grade him as an F. I think he cost them too many games this year where he simply either overmanaged or misread the situation. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm the least bit surprised, because if you recall, Charlie Montoyo came to Toronto because he had a great reputation in the minor leagues as a winning manager. I think he won 6 international division championships. So this is not some, you know, Johnny-come-lately passing ship. This was meant to be a manager that, very much like Sheldon Keefe of the Maple Leafs, and Nick Nurse of the Raptors, was supposed to take all that experience in the minors and grow with the team. My problem with Charlie Montoyo is I don't feel he's that kind of manager. I don't think he's really a grow-with-the-team kind of manager, because part of that growth is being a leader at the right time. And if your team is losing ball games because you're making the wrong personnel moves, or you're making the wrong pitching switches, or you're not paying attention to the way the game plays, again, free to scrutiny, because that's what fans do. But at the major league level, the expectation is you make the right calls. And everyone that you don't, that leads to a loss, is another reason why you don't make the playoffs. So to me, I wouldn't stick with Charlie Montoyo. I might look towards getting a higher caliber experienced manager who's won before, so that he can teach this team the importance of making the right moves at the right time.
Ari, we have about a minute. The very last question I want to ask you is, with 3 games remaining, will they make the playoffs, yes or no?
I believe that they will not make the playoffs this year. But I also believe that in this kind of year where so many surprises happen and so many of their players have inspired people, I really like the characteristic and makeup and chemistry of this Blue Jays team. Criticism of Montoyo notwithstanding, they have the nucleus here in Toronto to do something that can be very, very competitive many years to come. In that respect, I think fans need to be thankful and appreciative of the fact that throughout all these difficult and adverse and dire times of coronavirus, entertainment and sports, it's nice to see that the Blue Jays have stepped up and given some people in this world a reason to really believe in the, not the enjoyment and glory of baseball itself, but what it means for teams to play and be competitive and resilient when it matters most, like the Blue Jays have been.
Ari, thank you so much for taking the time to join us yet again. What you said was a controversial / pivotal point of the season. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to do this, and I wish nothing but good health and spirits to all of you there at AMI. Cheers.
That was Ari Shapiro, who is the host of Whiskey and Cream podcast. You can get that on any podcasting platform, or if you just follow him on Twitter, he has it posted up there as well. Coming up next, we're going to switch gears to the Paralympic community. We're going to chat with Devin Haru, who was actually on the ground in Tokyo and interviewing athletes and everything in between. So stay tuned for that conversation next on the Neutral Zone, right here on AMI Audio.
If you want to leave a message for the Neutral Zone, call now. 1-866-509-4545. And don't forget to give us permission to use your message on the air. Let's get ready to leave a voicemail!
Welcome back to the second half of the Neutral Zone right here on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, alongside Cam Jenkins and Claire Buchanan. And we thank Ari Shapiro for joining us today. Joining us now, however, is Devin Haru, who was born in Saskatchewan and is now based in Toronto and works out of CBC as a reporter and covers the Olympics and Paralympic Games. Devin, welcome to the program. It's an honor to have you aboard.
And it is an honor to be here on a perfect Friday in October. I can't believe it's already October, but here we are. And yeah, just a pleasure to be joining you guys.
Let's get started by discussing how you became involved in covering both the Olympic and Paralympic Games.
It's a good question. And everything about my life and my career has sort of been serendipitous. And you know, I've written about this a lot lately, and I've talked about this a lot throughout my career. I think sport has this incredible ability to bring us together, to share in experiences collectively. So me, that's what this has always been about. I think we realize that more than ever over this pandemic about how much we miss that. And so when I think about my journey to be able to cover both the Olympics and Paralympics, I think it was always sort of my passion and joy for sports that sort of allowed me to cover both of those events. So yeah, this is back-to-back games, both at the 2018 Olympics and Paralympics and now Tokyo 2020, where I've stayed right through from the Olympics to Paralympics. And, you know, not many people, I guess, can say that. Of course, this past experience was pretty extraordinary, but I feel so grateful to be able to do it because, and I hope we have a chance to talk about this in this conversation. I think we have a long ways to go when it comes to the Paralympic movement and the spotlight that needs to be put on it. And to be frank, as Canada's national public broadcaster, I feel an immense responsibility to give everything that I have to the Paralympics and to those athletes when I'm on the ground covering it. So I feel very fortunate to be cover both the Olympics and Paralympics. It's vitally important to me, and so important that we give the Paralympians the spotlight they so deserve.
Yeah, and just, you know, before I ask you the question, Devin, I just want to say that I think you did wonderfully in being able to share the Paralympian stories and to keep everybody up to date as to what was going on. And, you know, like, we're slowly getting there to where we need to go to get the Paralympians to shine the spotlight on them. So I think you, in particular, did a really good job in being able to do that. So I just want to say that before I ask my question. You're more than welcome. Now, you were part of go ahead, Devin.
Well, no, I was just, thank you for that. And it was really, it was fascinating for me to see sort of the social media buzz and our numbers. While I don't know them specifically, I've heard that our numbers were outstanding for how Canadians consume these Paralympics. So all of these are positives, but you know, we still do have a long ways to go.
Yeah. Now, you were part of a select few media members that got to go to Tokyo. Now, is there a specific process you had to go through to be considered to be going to Tokyo as a reporter?
That's actually a really good question. And to be honest, I don't know the answer to that. I know that our CBC team was much smaller than it normally is when we go cover an Olympics. So I know there were decisions that had to be made that were way above my pay scale, no doubt. But these restrictions, the protocols, even everything leading up to the games, all of the testing I had to do, all of the different forms I had to fill out, this was a huge commitment. And I have the flexibility in my life to be able to go early. I was there in Tokyo for 51 days. The only Canadian reporter that was there both for the Olympics and Paralympics. So it was a huge commitment. And let me tell you that it was the most rewarding experience in my career, but it was also the most challenging experience in my career just because of everything going on, the restrictions. The Olympics and Paralympics are restricted at the best of times, throwing a pandemic. And I know you guys can only imagine what that would have been like on the ground. But I don't know the process. I just know I was there. I didn't get a lot of sleep, and I ate far too much 7-Eleven food. That's about all I got for that.
You said that you were the only Canadian reporter there. Roughly speaking, how many members of the media as a group were in Tokyo on the ground with you?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And let me sort of just reflect, because over the years, with these national media outlets, from the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, Canadian Press, CBC, we all kind of see each other. And it's all sort of like a family reunion when we get to the Olympics or Paralympics or these international events. It was smaller. It was absolutely smaller. And there were national reporters who I won't name that wish they could have been on the ground, because listen, we know as journalists and storytellers that proximity is power. This is a magic sauce that to me sets journalists apart, the ability to be there, to be able to paint a picture, share the emotion of the moment. And I think journalists had a really, really hard time navigating these games and being able to tell the stories the way we normally would. So I'm thinking about the swimming venue, the Tokyo Aquatic Center. You know, that was sort of a marquee place where Canada won 6 medals during the Olympics. And there were probably just a handful of us on any given day covering these stories and actually in the scrum speaking to the athletes. So you can imagine how many news outlets were staffing these games and having people either at home back here in Canada or in their newsrooms here in Canada, and no doubt were up against it and trying to tell these stories of what was happening. You guys, I can't even begin to tell you how surreal and eerie and bizarre it was to be in these venues, both at the Olympics and Paralympics, when there was a gold medal moment and there was nobody in the venue to celebrate that moment. I've never seen anything like it. And yet the athletes performed in the way that we thought they would perform. So I think it just, you know, I give them a lot more credit than maybe a lot of other people have, considering they persevered in those really bizarre circumstances.
So Devin, can you maybe talk a little bit about the day-to-day as the member of the media there, especially with the pandemic going on?
Yeah, so it was funny, before you guys called me to be on the show, I was thinking about where I was, you know, a month ago right now, and I was actually preparing to go to a semifinal women's sitting volleyball game. And so, for example, on a day like that, I would be waking up. I had to, every single day I was there, do a COVID saliva test. I had 2 health apps on my phone that I had to check off every single day. To be allowed in venues, to be honest, to be able to move anywhere. So that's right off the bat to start the day. Then you would get to the venue. There were temperature checks at every venue, everywhere you moved. You'd go through security screenings as well. So then you would get into the venue. Normally, and people who are familiar with international sporting events would be aware that there's a place called the mix zone, and that's where athletes have to pass through at the end of competition and speak to media. These mix zones were kind of weird and different in a way, because of course you couldn't get close to the athletes. Everyone is wearing masks both outside and inside. And so in these mix zones, we had these long sort of boom mics set up 6 to 8 feet away from the athletes. And it was a different experience for the Olympians and Paralympians as well, because a lot of times they would come through this area. They didn't know where to stand. They didn't know the protocol around it. So I think it was a real learning exercise for everyone. And for me, with these really restrictive movements. It was just this sort of day by day, get through day by day and provide about anywhere from, you know, I had 15-hour to 20-hour days for about 51 consecutive days. So it was a grueling exercise, and you add everything on top of it. And, you know, I wouldn't say I was ready to come home at the end of it because I just loved the games, but a rest was certainly needed with everything that went into being able to cover these games.
We're joined by Devin Haru, who is a reporter for CBC and was the only, I repeat, the only Canadian that was there for both Olympic and Paralympic Games. And it's an honor to have him on. And I'm joined by Cam Jenkins and Claire Buchanan. And of course, you're listening to The Neutral Zone on AMI Audio.
With so much success at the Paralympic Games with Team Canada, I know it's going to be hard to choose, but what would you say is your favorite story that you covered at the games and why?
You know, I thought that question might be coming for me. So I did prepare a little bit for that. And yes, it's hard for me to pinpoint one exact moment, but maybe I'll entertain you guys with a couple of really sort of spellbinding moments that stuck with me. Of course, anybody that would have been following the games would have known the wonderful story of 35-year-old Greg Stewart, who won gold in shot put, his Paralympic debut. I'll never forget. And, you know, he's a 7'2" friendly giant, right? The gentle giant. And I'll never forget you guys at National Stadium watching him step into the stadium. I'm getting goosebumps telling you this right now. Watching him come out of the entrance and into the stadium, he was dancing. He was lit right up. He was so energized, fired up. He comes out and sets a Paralympic record, which was good enough for the gold medal in his first throw in a Paralympic Games that he's been trying to get to for 20 years. And it was just, you know, to me, this is the magic of the games, that on this one day, this one singular moment in these high performance athletes' lives, they have to be the best they can. And to see Greg Stewart step into that moment and into his light on that day, it was just awesome. And then being able to get to talk to him, yeah, he draped in the maple leaf with an interview right after it. And I said, "Greg Stewart, you're a Paralympic champion. How does that sound?" And he had been so poised and so composed the entire day. And when I said that, he broke down in tears and tried to describe the moment. And it really sticks with me. And then another moment was Stephen Daniel, the triathlete out of Calgary. He won a bronze medal on a scorching day at the Odaiba Marine Park in Tokyo, along Tokyo Bay. He collapsed. He collapsed and had to be wheelchaired off and get medical attention after the race. And it just, to me, it just told the story of courage, of bravery, of perseverance, and just how much it means to these athletes. I could go on. Danielle Doris from Moncton, New Brunswick, who set the world record twice in one day on her way to gold, just beaming at the Tokyo Aquatic Center. Orly Rivard, Brent Lakatos. We have so much to be proud of, and yet I just tweeted before I came on the air, Canadian Paralympians do not receive any money for medals. Canadian Olympians do, and I believe that's something that has to change if we want to talk about inclusivity and equality in sport in this country. So I wanted to make sure to get that in, because these Paralympians, like we said, they deserve the spotlight, but they also, you know, deserve the financial recognition that Canadian Olympians do as well.
You made 7-Eleven quite the thing over there in Tokyo. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
I mean, I don't know how it happened, but it was pretty incredible. So, you know, for the first 2 weeks of arriving in Tokyo, we were confined to the media transport, the venues, and the hotel didn't have many dining options, but there was a 7-Eleven attached to the hotel. And so I started going there. And of course, for anyone who follows me on Twitter, I like to tweet all of my experiences, so I started to tweet sort of the cuisine and the choices the culinary choices at 7-Eleven, which is very different from what we've experienced in Canada. You can get everything from sushi to the best dishes to the best desserts. And so I started to tweet what I was eating at 7-Eleven, and I guess the right people in Japan saw it, and it absolutely, you know, it spiraled out of control, and I gained about 20,000 followers in a week. I felt an immense amount of pressure to tweet out what I was eating from 7-Eleven every single night. And even to this day, people are sending me packages to the CBC from Japan with treats from 7-Eleven, and I've received dozens and dozens and dozens of letters from people across Japan thanking me for highlighting the great food choices at 7-Eleven. So did I think that I would become famous over my choices at 7-Eleven? Absolutely not, but I embraced it fully. I had a lot of fun with it, and it seems to follow me. I don't know what's going to happen at the Winter Olympics. I don't know if there's going to be 7-Eleven in Beijing for me to get to, but let's just say that was a Tokyo experience, and people seem to really enjoy it.
Devin, I've got to ask you before we let you go, did they have the those taco things that are baked and fried and they're just delicious and wonderful? Because if they did, I'm all over that.
They did not. They did not. And I actually wrote a piece. I think they're called taquitos. I think that's what they are. And they did not have those, nor did they have big gulp Slurpees. But they had onigiri. Like I said, they had sushi. They had these edamame chips, you guys, that I ate every single night. Poke sticks, obviously. I mean, they have the best snacks you could imagine. And I got to admit, when I talk to you right now, I'm kind of wishing I had a Friday night at a Japanese 7-Eleven for some snacks. But here we are, and it was a great experience. And it's certainly something that I feel really honored to have been taking part in, something I'll never forget in my career. And you know, I'm just really great that I could be on the show today and share it with you guys.
Devin, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And I love the fact that we got to share some giggles over your experience, some goosebumps. We went through all the feels during that, you know, 15-minute interview. Really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you on again before Beijing.
I would love that. Always here to chat with you guys, and you have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you so much, Devin. That was Devin Haru, who was the only reporter for Canada that was able to spend his time at both the Olympic and Paralympic Games. And as I said, we'll have him on again down the line before Beijing 2022. Coming up after the break, we're going to switch gears to the mainstream sports world, talk a little vaccination and exemption. We're going to get into that conversation on the other side of the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Neutral Zone right here on AMI Audio. I'm your host, Brock Richardson, and I'm joined by Claire Buchanan and Cam Jenkins. And Cam has some breaking news. Let's hear it.
Well, according to TSN hockey insider Pierre LeBrun and Aaron Dreger, the team has the Vancouver Canucks have agreed to terms with defenseman Quinn Hughes and forward Elias Pettersson on multi-year contracts. Hughes has reportedly agreed to a six-year contract extension with $47.1 million, while Pettersson has agreed to terms on a three-year deal worth $22.05 million.
Ah, very good signing there for the Vancouver Canucks. Kind of helps them in the quest to make the playoffs. Quinn Hughes is a very good athlete, and so that will help there for sure. Thank you, Cameron, for that breaking news in the middle of the show, which I have to say to the listener, we've had that breaking news button, and we've only gotten to use it like twice, so it's nice for our technician, Akil, to be able to push that button for us, and nice to have something break. It always seems to break either right before or right after the program, so it's good to get that button out there. Let's discuss something we chatted about regarding in the headlines regarding people that are asking for exemptions of the COVID vaccination. And as I mentioned off the headline, Andrew Wiggins was denied his quest to not be vaccinated due to religious reasons. What do you guys make of this? Claire, start with you on this one.
I want to start by saying that we all know that different provinces and states and countries have managed the COVID vaccine process differently depending on their protocols and what they've created within their regions. And so I'm fully for players who aren't vaccinated not being able to play certain games. And I realize that there's always some degree of exemption there in regards to Andrew Wiggins and Kyrie Irving that have decided to say very little about their reasoning other than making a statement of it's a religious reason. It's, for me, I would want a little more detail before making an opinion on that. It's, everyone has their own choice in what they do, including getting vaccinated or not. And also their religious status and what they consider, what religion they follow is also up to them and part of their private lives. So I understand why they are kind of keeping to themselves and not wanting to kind of stir the pot even more. But I'm definitely on the side of it. It's coming from a medical standpoint of wanting to keep not only the players and staff safe, but also everyone who's in attendance to see these games. It's where we have to think about the actual fans that are going to be there as well. So it's I know it's state to state and stuff, but I'm fully for the vaccination.
Yeah, you know, I'm fully for the vaccinations as well. I know there are very minute, health reasons not to get the vaccine. From the religious perspective, I've never really had a discussion on that, so I can't really talk to that. You know, it just comes from thinking of other people and making sure that you're vaccinated. So, as Claire mentioned, other players, staff, fans in the stand don't get it. And so I think it's very valuable to do that. However, it is your body, your choice. So at the end of the day, with the COVID tests that are the fast COVID tests, you could also use that to make sure that, you don't have COVID. So you're able to play. So they may come up with something like that. And yeah, at the end of the day, I think it's a lot more safe to be vaccinated, but maybe that's a secondary way to look at it and to do it with the fast COVID test.
I think the thing that sort of puzzles me on this, guys, is when we talk about things like this, reasons why or why not to get this, we tend to see people use things that if we dig a little deeper, it becomes almost an infringement on their rights to do that. So they're not coming out and saying, I'm not getting the vaccination because of religion, because of this. They're coming out and using it as a blanket statement because part of that is they know the privacy related to religion, and it's hard to dig it out of people based on the privacy alone. Cameron, I want to ask you, because Toronto came out later this week and said that they would allow players who are unvaccinated to play in Toronto. Does that change your opinion as a fan or your comfort level as a fan to consider going to the games? Or are you far enough from the players in which that it doesn't matter? Because we know the fans have to be vaccinated. We've got a little under 2 minutes.
Yeah, for myself, if it's just one or maybe even two players and I'm in the stands, you know, my comfort level will be pretty good because I do have my two vaccinations. So, like, I wouldn't have a huge, I wouldn't have a huge deal to do with that. The only thing I would hope is that they have, like I mentioned earlier, that they have the rapid testing to do to make sure that they're not sick or have the virus before they start to play the game.
If someone offered you courtside seats, do you take them, or are you happier in the stands themselves?
Why are you doing this to me, Brock? That's a great question. I don't know. I would definitely be putting a face mask on, maybe even two face masks. I'd probably do it, but I'd have face masks.
Courtside seats, Claire? Yes, no, unvaccinated?
For courtside seats, I'm showing up in a hazmat suit.
There you go.
Fair enough. That is quite clear on what Claire Buchanan feels about courtside seats.
Go, Raps, go.
In a hazmat suit. Love it. That is the end of our show for this week. I'd like to thank Claire Buchanan and Cam Jenkins. I'd also like to thank our technical producer, Matt Agnew, and Akhil Chin-Sang. Our technical supervisor is Paula Deneen, and our manager of AMI Audio is Andy Frank. Tune in next week, because you just never know what happens when you enter the neutral zone. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week. Be safe.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.